the question was raised last week, and I answered it quickly, but I'd like to elaborate a little more on it. It was a very, very important question. Question was raised. This is the question. Question is, the Ben Noach, is the Ben Noach obligated to keep those seven laws due to Sinai, or is it due to the covenant that was given to Noah from God? Okay, that's the question. That's a very good question. Now, someone asked me last week, I believe, did God reinstate the seven laws? And I said, yes. In a sense, that is true. In a sense, it's not true. In a sense, it's true because, yes, the seven laws at Sinai were reinstated. But the question that I'm asking now, I don't know if the questioner meant this or I'm just elaborating on this point, but it's, the question should be brought out into the open. Anyways, the question is, what obligates the Ben Noach? In other words, is it because God spoke to Noah that he's obligated? Or is he obligated because of the event at Sinai where the Torah was given? Okay. Now you ask me, well, what's the difference? If it's from Sinai or if it's from Noah? Well, first of all, it's important that we should know what is the obligating factor. That's important. We should have a knowledge and understanding of it. That's number one. But two, there is really a practical difference. I'll get into the practical difference in a moment. But the answer to the question is, it is definitely Sinai. There is no question about it. In other words, the Ben Noah is obligated to keep the commandments, to keep the seven, okay, and he has a potentiality to fulfill others on a voluntary basis. This is all due to Sinai. It's not due to the fact that God spoke to Noah. Even though it's true that God did give these commandments to Noah, but at Sinai, the whole system was the final structure of the system. Okay? All right? Now, I'll explain why that has to be that way. The reason why that has to be that way is very simple, because before Sinai, it says that you will be to me a nation, a kingdom of priests. Okay? And it also says, the prophets, for from Zion Torah shall come forth. So once the whole Torah was given at Sinai, with all the intricate laws and details, and this was given over to the children of Israel, that this is their responsibility. So all the seven laws, everything, the whole system was given to them. So that is their responsibility. And they are the ones that are to interpret the law, because there's only one law. They're the ones to interpret the law, and the interpretation of the law and the guarding of the law is given over to Israel. And that means the entire law, including the laws of the seven laws of Noah. So there was never any entrusting, separate entrusting after that point. Everything was entrusted to the children of Israel. They're the kingdom of priests. Now, priest means that there's a laity. The laity is the rest of the world. So that means that the children of Israel now were charged at Sinai with the responsibility for the entire law. And, again, this is a verse in Psalms as well, where it says that he speaks his words to Jacob. Let me just find out where that is. Hold on 1 second. Okay, that's a verse in. In Psalms 147, 17, okay? Okay, it says he speaks his words to Jacob, his laws and his statutes to Israel. All right? He did not do so to any other nation, and he did not teach them the statutes. So this means that the statutes, the obligation to know, to be in charge of all the details of the statutes and the laws, and of course, as you know, I mean, you're more educated than the average Ben Noah, who thinks that these are just, you know, just the seven simple laws. You know that these laws are extremely intricate, complex, and they require a deep understanding and analysis. And the ones that were charged with that, as the priestly nation, which means to say that they're responsible to others, to the entire world, that was Israel. So at Sinai, Israel was charged with the with keeping, guarding the knowledge of the law and disseminating this law. So that's why once Sinai took place, so then everything starts from that point. The whole system for the world was set up at Sinai. That was the final setting up of the system for the entire world. That's why everything stems from Sinai. So even though it is true that Noah was charged with the seven laws from the time of Noah, the question is whether it's from the time of Adam or not. Okay, that's what we're going through right now in the tractate of Sanhedrin. But at any rate, from Noah, from the time of Noah on, there's no question about it that that the seven laws were given to Noah. Nobody argues on that point. Now you'll ask me what difference does it make. I mentioned before there would be a difference whether the Ben Noah was obligated because of the covenant with Noah or whether he was obligated because of the covenant at Sinai. The difference would be. There's one law that would make the difference, and that is in Genesis 9:7. Okay? Genesis 9:7, it says, "And you," speaking to Noah and his children, "be fruitful and multiply, and you shall be productive in the fruitful in the land and multiply in it." Okay? So there you have a commandment to engage in reproduction. All right. Now, if you'll notice, you see, there is no repetition in the Torah. That's one of the basic principles. If you take a look at 9:1. It says that God blessed Noah and his children, and he said to them, "Be fruitful and multiply and fill the earth." Okay. So why the repetition in verse 7? The answer is, if you look carefully at the Bible, you'll figure out the answer yourself. The answer is that in verse 1 it says God blessed Noah and his children. But in verse 7, he says, "And now you be fruitful and multiply." So they're two different, it's in two different contexts. The first one is simply a blessing of God that they should have the ability to be productive. And the second one is a commandment. There's a difference between a blessing and a commandment. Blessing is where God gives man an opportunity to do something. And a command is something different. A command is where he must abide by it. So since there is no repetition in the Torah, it's clear that the first statement is a blessing, and the second one is a commandment. Now that would be the sole difference, actually, between whether or not the Ben Noah would be bound by the event that took place in the time of Noah, or by the universal event at Sinai. Okay, the difference would be, is the Ben Noah obligated in the, does he come under the mandate of having children and multiplying? That law is that, the law of having children means that, one must reproduce, have a son and a daughter. That is the obligation of that mitzvah. The question is a Ben Noah obligated to do so? Now, it's clear from the Torah that the original B'nai Noah, in other words, when God spoke to Noah and his children, they were obligated to do so. So they had this obligation. But now what happens is, since the Ben Noah really is bound not by the first covenant that God made with Noah, but he's bound like everyone is with Sinai, that supersedes the previous covenant, because that's the ultimate formulation of the law. There is no difference with regard to the other laws, but this one is different. In other words, since the Ben Noah is bound by Sinai, he was relieved of the obligation to be fruitful and to multiply. That obligation he does not have anymore. That only exists till Sinai. Okay? However, were he bound by the covenant with Noah, if that was what was binding, then, of course, he would still have that obligation to be productive and to multiply. Okay? But, in fact, the Talmud states that he does not have that obligation. All right? So, therefore, there is a practical difference, and also there is of course, a theoretical difference, because it means that the system, when God gave the law at Sinai, it wasn't just for the Jewish people, it was for the entire world. So the Sinaitic event was one that was universal, and it placed the people of Israel in a position of responsibility insofar as the whole law is concerned. So therefore, the Ben Noah has to come under the obligations, the whole system that was created at Sinai, which was not just for Israel, as I said, but for the entire world. That is the formulation of the Talmud, without a doubt, that the Ben Noah harks back to Sinai just like the Ben Israel does. There is no difference on that score. Maimonides states that a Ben Noah is obligated because of Sinai, and he says the Ben Noah should know that that this is the source of his obligation, is the Sinai, the event of Sinai. But he should also know that the fact that these laws that were given at Sinai, that Noah and his children were also previously instructed and commanded to do them. But the obligating event is really Sinai, and it's not the covenant between Noah and between God. There is also another clear reason why this is so. If you remember, in the Bible we have the story of Simon and Levi, and that they wiped out the city of Shechem. And, of course, the question is, what right did they have to do so? They were B'nai Noach. They had the status of B'nai Noach. So what right did they have to kill the people of Shechem? Sechem, I think, I believe in English it's pronounced. Let me just quote you the verse of Maimonides for a second, okay? The verse of Maimonides, the statement of Maimonides. Maimonides is like this. He says, anyone who accepts the seven laws and is careful to do them is considered from the righteous of the nations of the world, and he has a place in the world to come. And he says, and that is if he accepts them upon himself, and he does them because God commanded these laws in the Torah. And he taught us through Moses, our teacher, that the sons of Noah from before were commanded to do them. Okay? So therefore, it is clear in my mind, and my mind states it quite clearly, that the obligation of the Ben Noah is the Sinai. Now, I'm going to tell you another reason why the obligation has to be Sinai. It's an important reason. You see, the question was why. Let me get back to Simon and Levi, that they wiped out, they destroyed the city of Shechem. What right did they have to do so? So the answer is because the people of Shechem violated the seven laws. One violation of the seven laws. They were in violation of kidnapping, because they kidnapped Dina, and the whole town, the whole city stood by, and didn't object to this. And you know that one of the seven laws is that the Ben Noach, the community, is not permitted to allow the disintegration of society through violation of these laws. And they stood by, so they were obligated as well. And that's why they were deserving death. That's the opinion of Maimonides. Nachmanides has a different opinion. He says because they were idolaters. But regardless, I'm not really going to go into that issue right now. It doesn't make any difference. The point I want to bring out is the following, that a Ben Noach, the question is, I mentioned this before, that when the people of Israel would conquer a nation, so they would always offer them first peace and give them the opportunity to accept the seven laws. By the way, the conquest was always done in a very humane way. As a matter of fact, when they would surround the city, they always had to leave one side open. They only allowed to surround the city on three sides. So anyone that wishes to escape for their life has a way out. There was never a kind of war where they simply surrounded the entire city as is done in modern warfare or ancient warfare and not to allow anyone to escape. They always allowed people to have an out. And also they always asked them first if they would be at peace with them. This is, according to Maimonides, seven nations that were in the land of Israel itself. But they would first ask them if they would accept the seven laws of Noah. Now, if they would accept them, so then everything would be fine. So the question, of course, is or simply if a Ben Noach, let's say for instance the case of Ger Toshav. Ger Toshav means that a Ben Noach comes and in the land of Israel and he wants to be a halachic neighbor, which means he's actually becoming a part of the group insofar as living in the land is concerned. And in that case, if he accepts he has to accept the seven laws upon himself. But of course, the question is, and we know that if one violates the seven laws, they're under the penalty of death. So the question is an obvious one: how could you accept a person to be a Ben Noach, but they weren't keeping these laws previously? So since they weren't keeping these laws previously, why aren't they deserving of death immediately? Okay. Now the answer is based upon what we are explaining now, and that is the difference between the obligating factor and the difference between Shechem and between after the Torah was given. The B'nai Noach, before the Torah was given, were obligated by the event of the covenant between God and Noah. And that covenant obligated them to keep the laws, and there was a tradition from the time of Noah concerning those laws all the way till the time of the Torah, okay, till the time of Sinai. And that's why there was no excuse for them not to do it. That was their obligation. But once Sinai came into the picture, now Sinai becomes the obligating factor. And with Sinai being the obligating factor, there is no more tradition from Noah. And therefore, anyone that is unaware, the obligation is upon the people of Israel to instruct and to teach the laws of the Torah that were given at Sinai. So therefore, anyone that is met, the obligation is upon the Jew to instruct them and teach them about the laws first. They don't have any prior obligation on their own, going back to Noah. That has been abrogated, because God knew that tradition wouldn't last forever. So what obligates the Ben Noah is the event at Sinai, and it's the same obligating factor for the Jew. It's a very important concept, because it means that we accept nothing other than the event at Sinai with all its magnitude.
Rabbi?
Yes.
I need to jump in right here for a moment, if I may. There are two or three things I would agree with you, your conclusions up to this point, except for one point on this. I think that at Sinai that we have, and I will use the word codification of the Sheva Mitzvah B'nai Noach,
yes,
with the various ramifications. Mm-hmm. But I would say that the Noahic covenant is still in effect regardless of Sinai, because God said the seal of the Noahic covenant would be the rainbow.
Mm, okay, let me explain that.
Okay, and then, all right, that's one point.
Okay.
Then two, when we come to Deuteronomy 32, and I can give you several other verses, but this one, it says, when the Most High divided to the nations their inheritance, when he separated the sons of Adam. See, at this point, we are all still the sons of Adam. He set the boundaries of the people according to the numbers of the children of Israel.
Right.
This verse here makes the distinction between B'nai Noach and B'nai Israel.
As far as inheritance
is concerned.
That's right.
And then you drop over to chapter 33 and verse 4 and says, Moses commanded us a Torah, even an inheritance for the congregation of Jacob.
Right.
Now, what I see in this, and again, I'm in agreement with everything you're saying, basically, except for this one point, that the Noahic covenant is still valid, but we must come to Sinai in order to find the ramifications of it. All right, another point that I would make, God made the covenant with Adam.
Right.
And, of
which
course,
one is that?
The Edenic covenant. And that if Adam ate of the tree of the knowledge of good and evil.
That was a commandment, not a covenant.
All right, it was a commandment, but he is still all involved in the Edenic covenant.
Well, you can call it a covenant, but a covenant is always something which is everlasting. A covenant is not just a commandment to one person.
All right, well,
that
see.
That wasn't really lasting. That was only on him.
All right, it was still. I think it goes to all mankind because since Adam died, everybody else dies.
Yeah, but I know,
so it's the ramification of it is still.
Yeah, but there's no prohibition to eat from any tree. That prohibition, which was the essence of that commandment, was abrogated. It was only a temporary commandment for.
All right, but the results of that covenant still in effect.
Well, yeah, but that's not the covenant anymore. The covenant is always a living, existing bond, which means it's bound to do something, and there's nothing that we have to do anymore because of the case of Eden.
It's gone.
And we suffer the effects, that's true, but that's not something we have to do. A covenant always means you have to do something.
Will the curse of death not be removed either during the age of the Mashiach or after that?
But that has nothing to do with what we have nothing to do. In other words, the commandment, the doing part was only Adam. There's nothing that we have to do. There's no more prohibition of against eating from the tree.
All right, but
a separate question of whether, according to Maimonides and the great group of scholars, no. Death will never cease.
The point we'll make during the conference, you said, and we've been taught that Adam had five of the Sheva Mitzvot, or some say six.
Well, we're going to get into that.
Okay, all right, but that's the only the point that I would make is with the rainbow, the covenant. Is still in effect, but at Sinai, the covenant is defined more distinctly. We don't have all the do's and don'ts till Sinai. So that's the only point I'm making.
What you're saying is that if you want to know what happened, you have to go to Sinai.
That's correct.
Right.
That's exactly correct.
But the actual obligation goes back to Noah.
That's correct.
I understand your position. I understand your position.
Okay.
And I'm not saying that position is illogical, but I'm just saying that it is a logical possibility. But I'm just saying that the Talmudic scholars outrule it because of the fact that and this would be a halachic difference. The halachic difference would be: is the Ben Noah obligated in reproduction? Okay, we'll get into that in a moment. But the question that you did raise against the Talmudic position, both positions make sense. I understand that you can understand them both ways, but. The oral law maintains that it's the other way. In other words, the obligation always goes back to Sinai. I want to get into a little bit why that should be that way. But I'm not saying your position is illogical, but the question you raise is a good one. You see, whenever God says forever and ever, it cannot be abrogated by Sinai. That's why the covenant, for instance, that we spoke about last week, the covenant of the circumcision. Over there it says, you and your children forever, forever. So therefore, whenever it says eternally, your children for generations eternally, then Sinai doesn't remove it. Now, with regard to Noah and his children, the commandments that he received when he came out of the ark, it does not say forever. But it does say forever with regard to the rainbow. That's where it says, that's where it says forever. It says in verse 9, I will establish the my covenant with you and for your children after you. That means of course eternally. So therefore the covenant with regard to the rainbow, okay, it says there will never ever be a flood. That's forever, okay? There's two parts to the covenant between God and Noah. The covenant, insofar as the rainbow is concerned, that is forever. That God will never destroy the world through flood again. Okay, so this is that part is forever. But the specific commandments, the Talmud says, the Orlo says, was not forever. Now let me just elaborate as to why this is so. You see, the part of our belief system, and this is an important thing, part of our belief system is that we are not permitted to accept certain evidence as, or so-called evidence, as being true. To believe, in other words, certain things. We are not permitted. Our belief system is not permitted to be is not permitted to be guided by just any kind of belief. In other words, if you have a faith healer, or if you have even a prophet, we aren't guided by that belief system. As you know very well, in Deuteronomy, if the prophet gives signs, even if the signs come into existence, come to be, we are not permitted to follow the signs of that prophet if he states something other than what we know from Sinai. So Sinai is the only thing that we are, only in the event of Sinai do we give credibility to. In other words, even if a prophet would arise and he'd say, look, I am telling you from God, he'd give a sign, and he'd say, and the sign would come true. And he would say, now I'm telling you, God tells you, do something other than you have in the five books of Moses. We are not permitted to follow that person. Okay? Why? Because our belief system is only, we are only to believe an event which took place in front of millions of people, a public event, and an event of the enormity and magnitude of the Sinaitic event. That's the only thing we are allowed to believe. In other words, the only way it would be possible for something to change in the Torah would be to have another revelation, just like we had at Sinai, and then God would say to us that the previous that Sinai is all the laws of Sinai have been abrogated. But of course, such a thing will not happen because God stated at Sinai that there will never be another Sinai. But I'm just telling you theoretically that would be the only possibility of because we're only permitted to believe something of the magnitude of Sinai. That is a part of our faith, Ben Israel and Ben Noah. So the Sinaitic event was really an event that established what our guidelines should be for credibility. And this is the only kind of event that we are permitted to give credibility to. Nothing else. Therefore, this concept is binding on a Ben Noah just as it is on a Ben Israel. As a matter of fact, the entire veracity, verification of the Torah is based on the fact that the event took place in front of the entire people. That is the entire verification of the Torah. So therefore, the Ben Noah has to be guided by such a verification just as much as the Ben Israel. So for that reason alone, it's necessary that all be committed to the Sinai event. That is the evidence and that is the proof. As it says in Exodus, where God said to Moses that I'm going to come to you in the thickness of a cloud in order to make myself known and that the people will know that the words that I'm giving are the to you are the true words of God. All right. So the tradition of Noah was binding on his offspring only up to a point. And you can realize why such a tradition can never go on eternally, because it will only be carried down for a few generations. But the event at Sinai, which was done in front of the entire people, recorded by Moses, a system of Torah set up, the scholars were placed in charge, that is the only kind of event that could be binding on every human being. That's the reason why Sinai is where everything stems from, a belief in Sinai. Okay? And that's why the system actually starts from Sinai. But the difference between the two positions, the position that David mentioned and the position of the Talmud, would be the question of this particular law. Is the Ben Noah obligated to have children, to marry and have children? Is the Ben Noah under such an obligation? Now, according to the Talmudic view, the Ben Noah is not under such an obligation. Okay, because at Sinai, when the seven mitzvot were framed, that was not framed as one of them. Okay. Now, I'm going to digress just for a second, because Tosfos asks a very interesting question. Tosfos' question is, how do we know that the Ben Noah is not obligated to have children? Okay? That's Tosfos' question. Why don't we say, on the contrary, since the Torah does say, be fruitful and multiply, what source do we have to contradict that verse? And to say that no, that was only given up till the time of the Torah. But once Sinai took place, then the B'nai Israel were given that responsibility, and B'nai Noah were relieved from that responsibility. Tosfos asks, he says, how do we know that? What's the source? So Tosfos says that maybe you will say, because we know from the oral law that there are only seven commandments. And since there are only seven, this would make it eight. And therefore, you see that the oral law, without which we can't interpret the Torah, the oral law stands very fast by the principle that there are only seven. And it must be that eighth was simply abrogated. So Tosfos says that wouldn't be a proof, actually. He says, why? Because when we say seven laws, we only mean seven negative laws. The number seven was only the authentic tradition that we have from Sinai is that seven is with regard to the negative prohibitions, except for setting up courts, which of course is positive, but it's in order to keep the negative. So that's not considered as a positive, as an intrinsically positive commandment. But, so Tosfos says perhaps there was another positive commandment. And that doesn't come into that number seven of the tradition, of the oral law. So Tosfos gives an interesting answer. He says no, because he says the law with regard to reproduction also involves a negative. And he says, and he explains it, he says, because only those who are obligated, in other words, there is a violation, onanism. You're familiar with the term onanism, which is the story in the Bible of Er and Onan, and where they spilled their seed and they didn't wish to procreate, and they were, and then it says that God killed them. So they were under the obligation to be fruitful and multiply. That's why they were deserving of death. But Tosfos says that it is ipso facto. In other words, if you're obligated to reproduce, then you're also prohibited, is a prohibition of spilling the seed, okay, which would mean masturbation. So Tosfos says, now, if, in fact, the Ben Noah were obligated to reproduce, then he would have an eighth law which he couldn't violate. In other words, an eighth negative law, which would mean that he would be prohibited to spill the seed. And he says, but in fact that we know, that there are only seven negatives, and there is no eighth. So therefore, he says, we must conclude from the oral tradition that the law of being fruitful and multiplying was only for the Ben Noah up to the giving of the Torah, but at that point, they were relieved from the obligation, and the obligation was placed upon the Ben Israel. Okay, that's Tosfos. I'm giving you the Tosafist proof for this fact. Okay. Now, by the way, it shows you what the prohibition of spilling the seed is really not like many people think, that it has to do with like killing someone. I mean, people always say that. But according to halacha, the halacha has a very specific concept behind it. The Tosafists state that the reason for the prohibition against masturbation is simply because of the obligation to procreate. In other words, the prohibition against spilling the seed is that one is, if one has the obligation to procreate, he's not permitted to divert the instinct into the realm of fantasy, because if the person should do that, then they will be removing themselves from the obligation to procreate. So the prohibition against spilling the seed is based upon the obligation to procreate. And since there are only seven prohibitions, not eight, so therefore we must assume that the obligation of being fruitful and multiplying is not an obligation to the Ben Noah. Now, what we should try to understand is, it seems we have to, let's just try to understand what we have here. What we have here, according to the oral tradition, is that the B'nai Noach were obligated in this commandment of reproduction until the time of Sinai. Then they were relieved of that obligation, and it was given to B'nai Israel. Now, why the change? Okay, I mean, we like to understand. Sometimes we can't understand. We say we don't always understand God's laws, but we're obligated to try to understand them. And what sense does it make that why the change? In other words, why were they relieved and why were they obligated? And it seems they were not obligated until the time of Noah. Okay, that's another thing. It doesn't say the with regard to Adam, it says be fruitful and multiply, but that was a blessing, and a blessing is not an obligation, as we said, as we stated earlier. So I believe the answer is that from the moment God entered into a covenant with man, okay, the moment God entered into a covenant with man, man had to accept upon himself the obligation to procreate, because that is considered a fulfillment of the will of God, that the species should continue. So the moment God entered into a covenant with man, it became mandatory, necessary, that there should be an obligation on the part of man to fulfill God's will and to procreate. Now, before the Torah was given, there was only one group which had the covenant with God, and that was the Bnei Noach. So therefore, the only way this commandment could exist would be in the framework of the entire human race. Now, once Sinai came into existence, again, there's the covenant between God and man, but in the covenant between God and man, there must be some group, at least, that accepts the obligation to reproduce. So then, the commandment could be fulfilled through the B'nai Israel on a mandatory basis, and of course, through a Ben Noah on a voluntary basis. But the commandment would be in existence with man. And in order to have a covenant between God and man, this is necessary. This much is necessary, that man accept upon himself the obligation to make sure that the species continue. But the obligation doesn't have to be on all of mankind. It must be at least on a part of mankind on a mandatory basis, and on all of mankind on a voluntary basis. That suffices to have a covenant between God and man. But before that, when there was only one group, then it had to be mandatory on all of mankind. Because you couldn't simply single out and say, well, this group's going to do it, that group. There was only one category, the category of B'nai Noach. And everyone came under that one heading, that one grouping. So therefore, it was mandatory for everyone to accept upon themselves the responsibility insofar as making sure, ensuring the survival of the species. But once the Sinai came into play, it wasn't necessary to have everyone saddled with the responsibility. As long as a group exists that will make sure that the species continues, that is enough to satisfy the requirement for God having a covenant between man and between himself. So it wasn't necessary to burden the entire world with that responsibility.
Rabbi?
As long as one group has responsibility enough, and as I said, the rest of the world could always fulfill it on a voluntary basis.
Rabbi?
Okay. Yes.
All right. This opens up another question in the in regard to the Ben Noach.
Okay.
If we're not commanded, if the prohibition is specifically for Israel, and it's not for the Ben Noach, and since the Ben Noach is to establish course to justice and maintain social order, all right, what about in countries and areas where people have more children than they can feed and they starve to death? Would the Ben Noach, if he had the opportunity, would it be his responsibility to teach them birth control and to teach them how to control their environment so that they could feed the people they have?
Now you're hitting me with a rough one. Okay, I mean...
Now, see, we have, in America, we have places where children are actually starving.
Correct.
Because they're just, you know, women are just having kid after kid after kid. Then there's countries around the world. So that would it be our obligation in the area of morals, ethics, and domestic tranquility promoting the Sheva Mitzvah? Should we do what I mentioned before?
Now let me answer that question in a very careful manner. Let me put it this way. There is certainly nothing wrong, as you can see, according to the Torah, for the Ben Noach to practice even total birth control. Okay? Even total birth control. There's no prohibition against for Ben Noach to do that. Now your question is, should you teach these people, or are we obligated to teach these people to practice birth control? Okay, that's a different question. Can they is one question.
All right, but the question would be to practice, if they were taking care of their families, feeding them, educating them, etc. I don't think there would be a problem, but the problem comes with when you have more population than the land can support.
It would seem rational. What you're saying would seem to be rational, but I would say that the first obligation that we have to these people is to teach them the correct way of the Torah. Now, in other words, the correct way of life, because obviously this is not their sole problem. The problem is they are not living by any kind of correct ethical standard. To begin with, and someone could say, well, if they let's say people wanted on a voluntary basis to do this commandment, are we to say that they aren't supposed to do this commandment? They aren't supposed to fulfill this commandment. Well, one might be able to argue and say, if we taught them the ideas of Torah, and we taught them how to live properly according to Torah, even if they were in a situation where they are in a situation where the land is fixed and they simply can't survive somehow. So perhaps they should simply be involved in reproduction according to the commandment, which is simply a male and a female. In other words, to make sure that the species survives and not a total a wipeout of the nation, which is what would happen if you practice total birth control. So it would be possible, really, even in a situation of dire
same problem, and the government has passed a law that you only have one child, maybe one child.
Right.
All right, so what these people are doing, in order, the male is seen so as superior to the female, and the female is in a very inferior role, that there are literally millions of babies killed every year, females, so the mother can keep having kids till she has a male. Now, that would go against it. Now,
that's why I'm saying that their whole ethical system is corrupt.
All right, well, that's the point I made to start with,
right,
that we've got to teach them they should have a mitzvah b'nei noach.
Right.
But the person that's hungry is not concerned with morals and ethics. They're concerned with food.
Well,
and so you have to start somewhere, and I think... you know, I think that you start with justice and you teach people the morals and ethics of justice, and then you bring the other aspects in. That's the point that I'm making. That,
well,
you can't abrogate. You've got to start somewhere.
Right. Well, I
where do you
that,
start?
Okay. In my opinion, I would, if you'd ask me what is the philosophy of Torah, where do you start? Do I start by stopping this starvation and satisfying the people in a physical way first, and then introduce the seven laws? Or do I say, no, the reverse? Let's take all the people we have and introduce them to the knowledge and way of life of Torah, and then naturally they will be able to get out of their problem. In my opinion, I think actually there is a verse in the Torah that has an answer to this question directly, okay? And I always like to cite the Torah. The Torah states in the in Genesis, you have the story of Esau and Jacob. Okay, and now Esau, as you know, and that is in, this will give you the text over here. It's in Genesis 25. Okay, now you know the story where Esau was a man of the field and Jacob was a man of the tent. He was a person that studied, learned, he stayed at home, and Esau was the hunter. And it says one day, and that's in 25:29, Jacob was cooking a bean stew, and Esau came from the field, and he was exhausted. Of course, you know, the Torah speaks, as you know, very very short and very terse, very tersely. So the Torah says he was exhausted. Obviously, that day he was... he was frustrated. He went out, and the Talmud says that he was engaged in some violations. He was that was the day that Abraham passed away, and he was ethically he became corrupt. But that's aside from the point. The point is that he came back. He was frustrated, exhausted, hungry, tired. He was an unsuccessful hunter that day. Okay. Now, then it says, Esau said to Jacob, give me some of that red stuff that you're cooking because I'm exhausted. And that's where he got his name, Edom, all right? And then Jacob responded and said, sell me your birthright, okay? Now, of course, you know what the birthright was. The birthright was the one who was the, in the time before the Torah, there was the oldest son was the one that had the responsibility like a Kohen, like a priest. So if someone came to bring sacrifices, he was the one that was in charge. He would instruct them about the true idea of what a sacrifice is, the true idea of God, and what's about to take place. And he would help them to, you know, in order to perform their obligations in general and with regard to sacrifices in specific. So the firstborn acted in those days like a priest. Okay, in the time of the temple. That was under the system of the B'nai Noach. Now, Jacob felt bad because he felt that a man like Esau shouldn't really be assuming that position because he was not a righteous man, and although he wasn't overtly evil, as we see from the Torah, ostensibly he made a good appearance, but in fact, his heart wasn't in it. So Jacob wanted to assume that role, take it away from Esau. I felt it wasn't proper for Esau to have that role. So he figured this is a good opportunity. Esau is exhausted. He wants food. He wants to eat. So he said, okay, fine, but give me the birth rate, and I'll switch places with you. From now on, when people come, they'll come to me. I will help them in the performance of their mitzvot. Okay? So now look at Esau's response. Esau gives an unusual response. It's verse 32. It says, and Esau said, behold, I am going to die, and what do I need the birthright for? Now, what does that mean? I mean, everybody's going to die, so what did Esau mean? Of course, we're all going to die. What's it got to do with the birthright? What he meant to say was this, that I am a man of the material. The birthright is a very nice thing to have. It's a nice thing to have the birthright when my belly is full and when I have my clothes on my back, when I have all my needs, then it's nice to have the religious aspect and to be the one that's in charge and act like the priest. It's a very nice thing. I enjoy it. But what comes first, my friend, is not that. It's necessities. It's food. These are the things that come first. So I'm about to die. You exaggerate, of course. I'm exhausted. I feel like I'm dying. And you're talking to me about birthrights. I mean, I'm hungry now. I need my first, let's speak about first things first. The first things are necessities, food, all the things that a human being needs. Then we could talk about luxuries. To Esau, functioning in the religious capacity was a nice luxury. He enjoyed it. But it's still a luxury. What comes first is man's basic needs and necessities. So that was the philosophy of Esau. And as you know, the Bible states that he sold the birthright. And right in the next verse afterwards, it says, and Jacob gave to Esau bread and the dish that he had, and he ate and he drank and he went. And then it says, and he degraded, and Esau degraded the birthright. Okay? Why was it a degradation? It was a degradation because the righteous person places his ethical needs first. They're primary. Esau placed them secondarily. He said, when I'm hungry, don't talk to me about birthrights. It's very nice to be religious and to keep God's laws. It's a wonderful thing, but first we need the physical things. That's a degradation of Torah. That's a degradation of God's laws. God's laws are primary. They're first. They're not secondary. So my recommendation would be that if you want to reach these people, reach them with God's laws. That's primary. It's not going to work if you're going to try to reach them through their bellies. In other words, first we'll satisfy their physical needs. Then we'll go and we'll talk to them about the seven laws. I don't think it works that way. It might work that way on a superficial way. In other words, of course, if you're going to talk to a person, Abraham set up a tent and he'd take the people in and he'd feed them and he'd talk to them about God. Yes, that is true. In terms of a personal interview, you're talking to a person, you try to win them over at the time and you take care of their needs. That's correct. But when you're speaking in general, the first thing has to be the ethics. So if you want to reach people, you really should primarily try to reach them through their souls. I mean, that's the most important thing. To try to take care of their problems. In other words, what I'm saying is the birth control problem cannot be isolated as a single problem away from the rest of the ethical system. I don't think we'll have success if we do it that way. I think we'll have success if we go in with a whole system and teach them the way of living and the correct way of living according to knowledge. Then we'll be able to take care of that problem as well.
Rabbi?
But to isolate it, I think, is not the proper approach.
All right. Okay. The point that I would make is that, again, we are in agreement, just a slight variance, that you have taught us and the other rabbis have taught us that we take people where they are,
mm-hmm.
and then we lead them into the Torah, the depths of Torah. So I would say, yes, we are teaching them morals and ethics, and we're explaining to them the reason we are teaching, and for instance, on the birth control issue, the reason we are teaching you this is, and then we go back and we would quote Torah principles, morals, and ethics based on pure monotheism.
Okay.
And most of these people that...
Well, you can give them food also the same manner. I mean,
sure.
You don't have to teach them birth control. I don't think it's the ultimate vehicle for...
Right. Well, I'm just saying that's one of the problems These people are, and I'll do specifically with China, these people are committing murder.
Absolutely.
All right, so we need to tell them, well, this is wrong. But now, what are they going to do? China's got how many, 200 and, or 350 million people, have a billion by the year 20-something? And, you know, they've got real problems there.
I agree with you on that one. I mean, if you went to these people, if they were interested in our advice, I mean, of course.
Sure.
But let's say they were interested in our advice, and we told them, look, what you're doing is murder. You're in serious violation of God's law. What you can do is simply not reproduce. That is not in violation of God's law, and that would be fine. To do it in such a manner would be appropriate. But I wouldn't say that ultimately we should try to teach them to never procreate, because it still is a voluntary commandment to make sure that the species survives. And if everybody's going to practice birth control, then the species is going to be wiped out. And I think we should allow them to realize that on a voluntary basis, they should be capable of performing the commandment. But I certainly are correct that we should tell them that what they're doing at this point is completely wrong, and they should really rather refrain from murder and refrain from having children. Then they would not be in violation of any of the seven laws of Noah. That would be appropriate. That I agree with you on that. Okay? So, at any rate, but of course you understand, David, that now you're agreeing with me that you go to Sinai and not from Noah, because if you go from Noah, then you can't teach this, because then they'd be obligated to procreate and you wouldn't be able to practice birth control. Okay? So what your last argument kind of goes against the first argument, but I'm just I know you presented it as a possibility. I'm just trying to clear up the issue by this example. Okay? Any questions? Are there any questions on the subject that we just discussed tonight?
All right, I'll make some closing comments from my point, my standpoint.
Okay.
That, see, in the area, and I don't want to just belabor the point of birth control, because that's not the issue. We could deal with any issue.
Okay.
But see, any time that you're dealing with men, that you talk about the voluntary aspect of it. Now, we have statistics to prove this, that among educated and intellectual people, when the world began to become overpopulated, the intellectual, sophisticated people did voluntarily cut back on the birth of children, but those that were not sophisticated and educated continued to procreate.
Right.
Now, by the year 2050, in America, white people will be a minority, and this in direct proportion to birth control among the whites. Now, these are facts, not fantasy. So you have to, it's not just enough to educate one group. We must educate everyone in every aspect and every facet of Torah.
I agree with
as
you.
The opportunity gives, and Don just said, we're out of time.
Okay.
So for one chance, I'm going to get the final word unless you jump back in.
No, I agree with you, sir.
Okay, well, we'll begin here next week.
Okay.
All right, thank you very much.